This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Ewart. Coming up, as Tonga bids farewell to their late Prime Minister Akalisi Pohiva, the debate begins over who will replace him. What exactly does the spirit of Vivali mean for Fiji and Australia as the two countries sign a new friendship deal? And what can be done to end the impasse between the Tongan Rugby League and their star players, with the threat of a boycott still hanging over the team? Those stories to come a little later in the program, but first, pressure is mounting on Solomon Islands in the United States after the government of Manasseh Sogavare opted to ditch its international ties with Taiwan and switch its allegiance to China. A proposed meeting between the US Vice President Mike Pence and Mr. Sogavare on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly has been scrapped, although it's understood the Solomon's Prime Minister might not be travelling to New York anyway. But more significantly, there are signs that Washington is looking at cutting funding to the Solomons, with the matter being raised before a House of Representatives committee, where Congresswoman Ann Wagner questioned Gloria Steele from the US Agency for International Development and First Assistant Secretary of State David Stilwell.
China coerced the Solomon Islands to make this decision before the communist government's 70th anniversary on October 1. Assistant Secretary Stilwell, have you considered traveling to Taipei in accordance with the Taiwan Travel Act to demonstrate America's support for Taiwan in the wake of this demoralizing event?
On the issue of the Solomon Islands itself, you know, we're concerned in that the, as you describe, intentional shifting over is really aimed at Taiwan and in shrinking Taiwan's diplomatic space, which we would, again, remind all players of the intent of the Taiwan Relations Act and the three communiques and all other agreements is to settle this problem between the PRC and Taiwan in a diplomatic and through dialogue and not through pressure, coercion.
Ms. Steele, can you explain the rationale for the increase in the Pacific Island funding? We've had a little bit of a preview of that and its strategic importance, but will any funding be directed to the Solomon Islands, which has just undermined U.S. strategic interests in Indo-Pacific?
We are reassessing our assistance to the Solomon Islands at this point. But we are working in other countries, Papua New Guinea, Fiji, the Micronesia, Marshall Islands, and all the other countries. They are strategically important to us, both from a security perspective and an economic perspective.
Gloria Steele from the U.S. Agency for International Development there, and the suggestion that funding might be cut and the meeting cancelled by Vice President Pence has prompted this response from the opposition leader in Solomon Islands, Matthew Wale.
There's no need for that overreaction. This is time for engagement. I don't myself support the decision that Sogavare and his government has made, but the decision has been made. We've got to mitigate the risks that come with it and work from there. And my counsel would be to Australia, New Zealand, Japan, UK, and America especially, to work to mitigate is to engage, not to disengage, not to step back.
At the Center for Pacific Studies in Hawaii, the director, a Solomon Islander himself, Dr. Tarsisius Kamputulaka, says the United States is in what he calls a complicated situation.
Because it does have diplomatic relations with China. And that's what other countries will always weigh, that the U.S. has diplomatic relations with China. Part of it is strained because of the current trade wars between the U.S. and China, but it still does have relations with Beijing. And so it raises the question, why does it tell other countries not to have diplomatic relations with Beijing? And so that puts the U.S. in a difficult situation. A bit of a political somersault on the part of the U.S. to be doing one thing and saying something else to other countries.
But when the dust settles, what will be the long-term impact on Taiwan of Solomon Islands' decision to cut ties after nearly four decades? Chui Liang Chao is a former advisor in the office of the Taiwanese president, and despite the blow of losing a diplomatic ally, he says Taiwan is actually in a better place than China when it comes to foreign relations.
In recent years, Taiwan's diplomatic relations have dropped from more than 20 countries to 16. Even if China buys all 16 countries with money, it doesn't matter. Taiwan now has semi-official relations with more than 160 countries in the world. To some extent, Taiwan's relations with the United States, Japan, and Australia are probably even closer than China's relations with these countries, except there is no political diplomatic relations.
That's Chui Lang Chau, former advisor in the office of the President of Taiwan. And while Solomon Islands may have turned their back on Taiwan, Palau's President Tommy Ramengasau Jr. remains resolute.
President Nakamura started the relationship with Taiwan, and so far we've had an amicable, workable relationship. We have yet to find out really why Solomon switched. They keep talking about some assessment or feasibility report. We'd be very happy to see what made them change their mind.
And the Parliament of Marshall Islands have just adopted unanimously a 3-page resolution recognising more than 20 years of ties between Majuro and Taipei. The resolution noting Taiwan's unwavering commitment to promoting freedom, democracy and human rights, and its impressive range of assistance, financial, technical, training and scholarships, all aimed at developing the Marshall Islands. So Taiwan clearly still has some friends in the Pacific, but that's very much a developing story. Now, the people of Tonga have farewelled the country's late Prime Minister Akalisi Pohiva at a state funeral in the capital, Nuku'alofa. Dignitaries and politicians from all over the Pacific joined the Tongan people to pay their respects, with the Australian government represented by Alex Hawke, the Minister for the Pacific. But while the focus was to mourn the leader Tonga has lost, some have begun looking ahead to what the future may hold for the kingdom, now that the man who fought for so many decades to wrest power away from the royal family has gone. Here's Catherine Grau.
Akalisi Pohiva had been making the journey between Tonga and New Zealand fairly regularly in recent months as he spent time in hospital because of poor health. This week, the New Zealand Defence Force jet brought the late PM back home for good. Tongans from all walks of life have been paying their respects, wearing black and the traditional ta'ovala mats around their waists. For a man who argued against extravagant use of public money, the Tongan government spared no expense to farewell the 78-year-old.
He will always be in the history of Tonga as the father of democracy. He took Tonga from absolute monarchy to a democratic government.
Malino Maka is the chair of the Tongan Advisory Council in New Zealand.
And even still in infancy, the democracy in Tonga in infancy, and some challenges. But nevertheless, he did it.
Akalisi Pohiva dedicated his life to the country's pro-democracy movement. He was jailed and charged with sedition twice during his fight to reduce the political influence of Tonga's royal family. But when he became PM, many say his own influence was far too controlling.
Akalisi is just like a one-man band. So once he's passed away, we still don't know, they still don't know, who is going to be the replacement.
Isipulu was a founding member of Mr. Pohiva's political party, but the two fell out several years ago. He's not the only one who believes that there's no heir apparent. Here's Malino Maka again.
He didn't have someone that he groomed to be the to take over the party. Because I remember I had a discussion with him one time and I asked him whether he had someone that he can groom to take over the party. But he just looked at you and... And I didn't think that he appreciated what was said.
Tonga's constitution lays out that nominations for the role of PM will start in coming days. Then Parliament will be recalled for MPs to vote. But with numbers fairly close, observers say it's a guessing game as to how things will play out over the next month. 9 parliamentary seats are still allocated automatically to nobles. There's also a handful of independents, and then the rest belong to what was Mr. Pohiva's Friendly Islands Democratic Party. But the editor of the online news site Matangi Tonga, Pesi Fenua, says it's a political party in name only.
The confusion that's happening is because they introduced this concept of a political party into the whole system. But there is no party in the Tongan parliamentary system. It is the people representatives and the noble representatives.
Mr. Fenua says that issue, among many others, will have to be addressed once a new PM is elected. But he says the need for more reform is to be expected, given democracy in Tonga only came into being with the constitutional changes of 2010.
They elected all these people and it was just a step, one step, one small step, still very much in the infancy. And ever since they introduced this in 2010, they haven't really amended anything. They haven't really adjusted or even think that the baby has grown up a little bit. Nothing.
Community leaders like Malino Maka say it's time for the government to get back to the business of running the country.
There were a lot of distraction on his leadership and also the way that the ongoing controversy, allegations about member of his cabinet. Remember, there are a number of his ministers was forced out and also sacked because of the alleged corruption.
In fact, there had been calls for the king to set up a royal commission to investigate allegations of corruption within government.
That's Catherine Grau reporting. I'm Richard Ewart, and you're listening to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. On his first official visit to Australia, the Prime Minister of Fiji, Frank Bainimarama, asked the Australian government for help at the climate talks taking place at the United Nations in New York right now. However, although Mr. Bainimarama and Prime Minister Scott Morrison have signed a wide-ranging agreement called the Vuvali Partnership, Australia's level of commitment to action on climate change has again proved to be a somewhat thorny issue. Here's our Foreign Affairs reporter, Melissa Clark.
It's the first time Frank Bainimarama has been afforded an official state visit to Australia. He was given a ceremonial welcome from the Governor-General, complete with an artillery salute, before being ushered into the Australian Parliament by Scott Morrison. The pair held a formal bilateral meeting and signed a wide-ranging agreement covering economic, security and community links. It's called the Vuvale Partnership, Vuvale meaning family. Speaking at the start of the meeting, Mr. Bainimarama suggested the Australian government would need to do more as a member of the Pacific family.
For Fijians, the bond that binds families together are sacred, unbreakable connections. It's about more than being good mates to one another. It's about the Vuvale connection demands a level of understanding hitherto unprecedented in the relations between our governments, but which has been long evident in the genuine affinity shared by the Fijian and Australian people.
Mr. Morrison, for his part, emphasised the strong people-to-people relationships to invoke Vuvale.
For whatever other complexities there are in the world today, one certainty is the relationship that exists between the people of Australia and the people of Fiji. And I think that will always endure. It is just too familiar, it is too close, and it will always be enduring.
Action on climate change has been the main rift between the Australian government and Pacific nations. At the leaders' meeting of the Pacific Islands Forum in Tuvalu last month, Mr. Morrison blocked efforts by the smaller island states to get unanimous support for a strong declaration on tackling climate change. Mr. Bainimarama was one of the most vocal critics at the time, but less so in Canberra.
Members of any family are entitled to their disagreements. No one expects that our differences can be resolved quickly or easily, but we must never falter in forging common ground.
Despite the cordial tone, Mr. Bainimarama did have requests for the Australian government. In a speech given to an Australian military institution that the media were not allowed to record, he spoke about his frustrations that the most recent UN negotiations on climate action did not consider the most recent scientific reports from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He blamed lobbying efforts by fossil fuel producers and asked Australia to join the Pacific in demanding the latest scientific reports be put back on the agenda at the next international negotiations.
And the reporter there was Melissa Clark. Now, it's been confirmed that the man who was the lead critic of Australia's Prime Minister Scott Morrison at the Pacific Islands Forum meeting in Tuvalu is no longer leader of his own country and won't be travelling, therefore, to New York to take on a prominent role at the UN Climate Summit. Following a general election 10 days ago, now former Prime Minister Anele Sopoanga has been voted out by MPs in favour of the long-serving parliamentarian Kasia Natano. In the end, Secretary to Government Tine Leolu says the influence of the new MPs was the deciding factor.
It was a quick meeting where everyone has to cast a vote through secret ballot. Honourable Kasia Natano received 10 and the Right Honourable Anele Sopoanga received 6. So the acting governor general pronounced the elect Senator Kausea Natano as the new prime minister.
What's the next step?
Well, the next step now is a meeting between the acting governor general and the new prime minister. They will go through, because he had to notify and advise the governor general the lineup of his ministers and the portfolios that they will be taking care of.
Can you tell us a bit about the new prime minister? What's his background and how long has he been a Member of Parliament?
He was a civil servant before. He stood as a MP for Funafuti. As a Member of Parliament, he was once a minister too. He used to be a Deputy Prime Minister as well.
In the lead-up to the election today, how did the MPs go about choosing their nominations?
They've been in contact with each other through internet and messaging, text messaging. So when they came onto Capitol, this was Saturday morning, all of them arrived on the same day from all the outer islands. They have already formed their own groupings. They started caucusing within their own distinct groupings of 10, and the other from the former government made up 6 of the other MPs. So they were like intensive lobbying.
Now, Tine, what's the reaction been like from the public after this announcement of the new prime minister?
So on the Capitol itself, it's like a reaffirmation of rumors they were hearing since Saturday. Straight after the election on the 9th, some were actually suspecting that there could be a change in government, given that there were 7 new MPs that came in out of the 16. 9 of them were former MPs. 5 are on the government side from the last term, 4 from the previous opposition side. I think everyone is glad that it's over now, that people have been speculating since Saturday on who might come in, who might not. But now everything is confirmed. I think everyone is looking forward to start working on their new mandates.
Secretary to Government in Tuvalu, Tine Lolu. He was talking there to Evan Wasuka. And you're listening to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. Former President Johnson Torobiong is warning that unless there are changes to the voting system in Palau at the next election, there could be serious repercussions. Mr. Torobiong says by continuing to allow expats who may not have set foot in the country for decades to vote, Palau runs the risk of handing over political control to people who don't even live there. And it's a concern that could impact on other small island states in the Pacific with large expat populations. The lobby group that's opposed to off-island voting in Palau is gathering signatures for a petition with the aim of forcing a referendum and, with the right result, a change to the constitution. Petition organiser Tuti Chilton says right now the political system in Palau is slanted, and when it comes to running for office, democracy is a luxury only the rich can afford, and only the rich, he says, can chase the votes.
If someone currently has money, they can go to Guam, Saipan, Hawaii, US, and court the voters, where someone on island may be a good leader, but just doesn't have the financial support to go off island, and that individual doesn't have the opportunity to serve his or her country.
At the forefront of the campaign to change the system and put an end to absentee voting is former President Johnson Torobiong.
So number one, democracy becomes too expensive for candidates. Number two, I believe in home rule. Those who would be governed by those who are elected should vote for them. Number three, it opens the door for corruption. And number four, given the high degree of out-migration of Palawans looking for a better life in the United States, very soon, if we don't change the system, the leadership of Palau will be controlled by those who do not live in Palau.
That's a startling claim, and one that electoral specialist Terence Wood from the Development Policy Centre at the Australian National University says doesn't necessarily stack up.
Even people who have migrated for a longer period may still have an interest in the country, people who plan to come home to retire or people who still have family there. So it's not inevitably the case that letting people who live somewhere else vote undermines a country's democracy.
But if former President Torobiong is right, then countries like Cook Islands, Niue and Tokelau, who have large expat populations in New Zealand, could find themselves in the same situation. And indeed, New Zealand itself already has restrictions, with voters required to have set foot on home soil within 3 years of an election if they want to take part. Meanwhile, as the petitioners continue to gather signatures in Palau, Judy Chilton says his sense is that those who do live on the island are supportive of change.
The internal support in Palau, I would guess if I meet 10 people, maybe 8 people would be very supportive of it. The other 2 or 3 have reservations on it. But we do all agree, at least let's put it up for debate and let the people of Palau vote on it.
If it passes, instead of the candidate traveling overseas to chase the voters living abroad, it will require the voters living abroad to come to Palau and cast their votes.
And former President Torabyong is also calling for a purge of the electoral roll in Palau.
So those who live in the United States may register to vote in, say, a state of IRAI. They still vote even though they've been away for like 20, 30, 40 years until they die.
When it comes to election time, Terence Wood argues that off-island votes in most instances won't make a difference to the final result. But in Palau's case, he concedes the situation there could be different.
So I can see why people would be concerned if they had one result on election day and saw that overturned because of a large number of absentee ballots.
So what are the prospects for change in Palau? Johnson Torabyong believes the people want it, but the politicians, he says, will try and stop it because they are the ones who stand to gain most from the status quo.
The problem is the incumbent who travel a lot overseas favour the current system because that's their advantage. They're the only ones who travel to Guam and Hawaii and the United States. But the new candidates, not known by the Palauan voters living abroad, have a disadvantage. That's why the incumbents are going around in Guam and Saipan and Hawaii saying, kill this proposed amendment.
In the meantime, the petitioners have work to do, with 1 in 4 of Palau's voting population needing to sign if there's to be a push for a referendum in time for the next election, which is due in May of next year. Finally, in this edition of Pacific Review, the top official in World Rugby League is in Australia and on standby, it would seem, to intervene in the dispute between Tonga's NRL stars and the Tongan board that is threatening to derail the national team. The spectre of a player boycott for the huge games against Great Britain and Australia and the Rugby League Nines World Cup just won't go away. Less than 2 years after the Mate Mar came within one controversial refereeing decision of making the Rugby League World Cup final, the future of the national team is on a knife edge with the threat of a player boycott still looming large. NRL star Andrew Fifita claims that he and at least 29 other players are ready to turn their backs on the national team unless a new board is elected and coach Christian Wolfe reinstated. The situation is complicated by the fact that Wolfe has just been appointed to coach the Super League club St Helens in England, while the board the players object to was only put in place at the end of March following a governance review. At the time, the new chairman, George Koloamatangi, said the growth of our game, the international recognition and standing of our national side has had a profound effect on rugby league in Tonga. Reform is merely a consequence of the performance of our national team. But the consequence of that reform has been chaos, and the newly appointed coach of the Mate Mar, Frank Endicott, has been plunged into a political row that he'd rather not be part of.
There's a lot more to this issue than I understood, and I've always said I'm not into the politics and will not be. So really, this needs to be sorted out by the players and the board, and hopefully by the end of the week.
With time running out to resolve the impasse between players and board ahead of Tonga's match against the touring Great Britain team next month, the NRL's international development manager, Taz Battiri, says the cavalry has arrived in the form of Nigel Wood, chief executive of the Rugby League International Federation, who has made the dash from the UK for talks.
Right now, Nigel Wood's in Sydney. Behind the scenes, there are things happening, but everybody's just waiting for someone to make a move. I don't know why the board terminated the services of Christian Wolfe. There might have been a bit of a head clash there in terms of philosophy or way of doing things, and that's what the board decided to do, which they're quite entitled to do because they run the game in Tonga.
And even though Nigel Wood is in town, his first lieutenant, Southern Hemisphere General Manager Jeremy Edwards, says the RLIF would prefer that, if possible, that same Tongan Rugby League board sort matters out for themselves.
We've been monitoring this situation for a number of weeks now and having a number of discussions with Tonga. I think a resolution can be made, but at the moment we are trying to get the Tongan guys to sort it out themselves, and that would be the best outcome for the international game of rugby league.
However, the newly appointed football director for the Tongan national side, Dwayne Mann, is cagey about the current state of negotiations.
Yeah, I want to make sure we can resolve it in both parties. We can move forward.
Are there signs of hope here? Because this is a key moment, isn't it, in the history of Tongan Rugby League, if this goes wrong after all the progress that's been made?
As soon as we can, we'll make an official comment.
And so the waiting game goes goes on, but Jeremy Edwards says he's confident a solution will be found and a full-strength Tongan team will take on the British touring team. But if they don't, Frank Endicott says the consequences could be disastrous.
This will set them back light years if they decide to boycott the series, because it won't go down well with the International Rugby League Board, and I don't think it'll go down well with their fans. They've got the best fans in the world. They're unbelievable, and to let them down would be terrible.
Tonga's National Rugby League coach in waiting, it would appear, Frank Endicott, rounding up this edition of Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. You can listen to the programme on demand at any time by subscribing to our podcast through your usual provider. I'm Richard Hewitt, and as always, thank you very much for listening.